You are listening to A Good Book on Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Kirin's The Spell of Noan, written and narrated by James D. Priest.
Barney picked up a stick and brandished it before the ravens. Then he stopped. "Something's wrong with those crows," he said hoarsely. "They're standing right in front of the mushrooms, almost like they're protecting them. Do crows eat morals? And what in blazes happened to that other mushroom?" He paused. "Something's wrong here. Let's go." He dropped the stick and was about to run, but Hazel hesitated. Taking a step toward her, the larger raven threw its head back, and from its throat poured the most enchanting song they'd ever heard, a melodic cascade of tones. The humans backed away, only to be stalked by the bird. Astonished, they turned and ran, crashing through the woods as fast as they could go. Hutt dropped the mushroom. He and Baron bounded joyfully toward the two ravens as an adult Kirin dismounted from each.
"Lingusta kor tikiam nona ad nona," said Rugum Chamter, a bearded clan elder, speaking softly but glaring at Hutt. "That was foolish, very foolish indeed."
"They couldn't see me," said Hutt.
"You might still have been detected," growled Rugum.
"Did you follow us?" asked Baron. "We happened by," said Deliani, a tall woman, her long black gown trailing on the ground. She gazed at Hutt with eyes darker and more penetrating than he'd ever seen. "We never interfere in the affairs of humans, but we feared you were in danger. We had to act. When the humans appeared, you shouldn't have moved. You should never have picked up the mushroom. Even morals aren't so valuable as to risk detection."
"They got away with 4, chirped Hutt. "The woman had them in her bag."
"Quiet," hissed Rugum, glancing about. "Humans are nearby."
"No, they ran away," whispered Hutt, grinning.
5, said Baron. "The man had one in his hand." "Never mind the mushrooms," said Deliani. "Could you understand their speech?"
"They like the looks of our mushrooms," said Baron, "but not your ravens."
The lads giggled, but were met by Rugum's stern gaze.
"You've had a close encounter with humans. Frivolity is not appropriate."
"If they can't see us," said Baron, "how can they hear and smell and feel us, as we've been taught?"
"If humans can't see us," said Hutt, "how do animals, birds, and insects see us?"
"Important questions," said Deliani, "but this is hardly the time or place to discuss them. You did well in finding your mushrooms. We'll be back with others from the clan to transport them." Climbing onto their ravens, she and Rugum entwined their feet beneath the birds' necks, as only Kirin's can. Then, speaking soft commands, they lifted off and headed the short distance to the home tree. That evening, excitement filled the air as the Yorl clan awaited word from their magician and those involved in today's startling events. The clan's gathering place was a circular wooden platform fixed securely to the boughs of a giant oak tree a considerable climb above the forest floor. At the platform's center, a fire burned on a flat stone fireplace, flames and embers contained by a border of large stones. Apart from their families, Hutt and Baron stood restlessly beside the fire. Behind them, and on nearby branches above, the clan waited cheerfully. The blaze projected enough light for the lads to see undulating shapes and outlines, the clan's ravens and squirrels maintaining a vigil at the edge of the platform.
"The scent of cooked morals is still in the air," said Shalkin,
sitting with his small daughter on a branch. "Can you smell it?"
"They were good,"
she said, nodding and smiling. She pointed to Hutt and Baron.
"They're going to speak tonight?"
"They saw human beings today," said her father, "which is rare. But much more than that happened. Clan members made contact with the humans, actually confronted them. I can't tell you when that last happened with Kirin's anywhere. No one in this clan's ever done it, until today. The boys will tell us all about it."
"Don't humans know we live here?" asked the girl.
"I hope not," said her father, shaking his head.
"Can't they see our fire?"
"A clan gathering, even with a fire and after dark, has proven to be safe. Our gathering place is high in the tree, hidden from below by the trunk and branches. Should humans happen by, they can't see the flames, and the smoke drifts silently upward."
"Why do we hide from them?"
Her father smiled. "Long, long ago, the two races cooperated and knew each other well. Then something happened. Nobody remembers what, but we Kirins had to separate from humans and protect ourselves from them. To help with this, our magicians cast a spell making all Kirins invisible, but just to humans. All other creatures can see us. It's called the Spell of Noan."
"Can't humans see our clothes?"
"Anything we're wearing or holding becomes invisible, too."
"Do they hear us?"
"They can hear, feel, smell, and, heaven forbid, taste us." She giggled.
"What do we taste like?"
He patted her head. "I think you'd be pretty sweet, little girl." Heads turned as the tall, stately clan magician approached the fire from the side opposite Hutt and Baron.
"Spekeren," whispered Shalkan. "Now we must be quiet."
Stopping before the fire, Spekeren faced the lads and spectators, his hooded gown yellow, his mustache and beard gray, a luminous globe in his hand. Green eyes glimmering, he placed the orb on a standard beside him. He gazed at the boys across the fire, then asked them to turn toward the clan and recount today's remarkable events. To the enchantment of all, the lads told everything that occurred that morning. At the end of the lads' account, Spekeren spoke. "Our encounters with humans are confusing, both to them and to us. Contacts with them must be handled with great caution. Humans were once our allies. I hope they will be again." With the large gathering over, the magician convened a smaller meeting in his apartment. Seated about his fireplace were the principals in today's events, Hutt, Baron, Ruggum, and Deliani. "I don't condone what you did today, Hutt," said Spekeren. "Spiriting the mushroom away from the humans was dangerous, but it did confirm what the Spell of Noan does. Your picking up the mushroom made it disappear from the humans' view. Deliani tells me they looked bewildered and obviously didn't know what had happened. She also tells me you understood their language. Now you can see why we teach it in school." He paused. "I have something which might interest you, especially after today." Getting up, he went to his cluttered workbench, looking for a document. Returning, he read it aloud. "Humans who have seen Kirins have referred to us as elves, gremlins, fairies, brownies, dwarfs, kobolds, rhina, leprechauns, trolls, menehune, tomte, and gnomes. Legends about small beings the world over have arisen from these infrequent sightings." He looked up. "Sightings of us? Yes, to humans we're almost always invisible. But under rare circumstances, we're not." Chapter 4. prior to flying on birds, many children of the Yorl clan and surrounding clans enjoy a learning period, playing and practicing with squirrels, preparing for the time when the young Kirins will fly. As Hutt left the meeting in Spekeren's apartment, one of the squirrels on the gathering platform approached him, then became quiet and attentive. Hutt was small for his age, but made up for it with verve, determination, and daring. He was always interested in something adventurous in the forest, even if it bordered on perilous. He sometimes had to be dissuaded from activities by friends or elders. Though disapproving, Rugum and Deliani hadn't been surprised by his snatching the moral mushroom from the humans. Hutt greeted Stala, his squirrel, with a hand on the animal's ear and a word, Oran. Moving not a muscle, the squirrel stood awaiting a command. Hutt gazed into the surrounding forest. Only the closest trees were visible, others fading into the blackness of night. "I'd love to take you for a ride," said Hutt, "but I'm told never to ride after dark. I'll be out early in the morning. Perhaps Blinda and Asa will join us." He hoped his younger sister would be in the mood for an outing on her squirrel. Departing, he knew Stala would observe him until he was out of sight, then go on to his own place in the tree's upper branches. Climbing the tree toward home, Hutt's long, narrow feet and strong tendons propelled him with astonishing results. Suddenly realizing that, he slowed to look down at his bare feet and remembered what his mother had told him. At birth, Kirin's feet are the same size relative to their bodies as are humans' feet. But Kirin's feet grow more rapidly during the first few years of life. As everyone knows, from Kirin to Kirin, eventual foot size varies. "My grandfather's feet," he thought, "are among the longest in the clan. He's proud to say that our feet thrust us to lengths, heights, and velocities that might otherwise not be possible for beings of our stature. The larger the foot," he says, "the more agile the Kirin." "Mine might still be growing," thought Hutt. "I hope so." One might think Kirins who live in trees live in simple tree holes, but the size, comfort, and warmth of their homes far surpass that. Because Hutt was small, he entered his family's dwelling without stooping to get through the doorway. His father and grandfather, sitting by the fireplace in the entryway, turned to greet him. The small room was carved into a large branch, as were the apartment's other rooms. In fashioning their homes, tree-dwelling Kirins take great care to preserve the tree's life functions. An experienced tree architect plans and supervises construction. Tree carvers perform the chiseling and sculpting. Chosen trees are damaged as little as possible. Some rooms are built adjacent to the trunk and branches, but not within them. Those chambers outside of the tree are made to look like the lumpy outgrowths on older trees. Lighted by the fire, the entry room was cheery. Hutt's father and grandfather were engaged in a practice commonly enjoyed by Kirins of the region, especially on chilly nights, warming their feet by the fire. Hutt remembered something unusual. "This morning," he said, "a beautiful song from Rugum Champter's raven frightened the humans away. I've never heard of such a thing." "Rugum," said his grandfather, "is one of our finer practitioners of Curlace magic. His old Eilon, Alsanam, has been with him for 20 years. He's trained the bird to do many unique things. Singing is one of his more creative efforts." "Curlace," said Hutt's father, "through which we instruct animal and bird species, in our case squirrels and ravens, is a revered activity. As you know, some Eilon are captured, some born into Eilon families already under our influence. They enjoy a charmed life and can live 8 or 10 times longer than their untamed counterparts in the wild. When you consider it, both we and our Eilon live remarkable lives. As for the humans, chuckled the grandfather, I'll wager they're still running. They'll never tell a soul about the incident for fear of being ridiculed to death. Hutt thought of Stalla and tomorrow morning, and what might be one of his last rides aboard his old chum. Hutt was getting to the age when he could, even should, graduate from squirrel to raven. But the change from animal to bird signaled a milestone, and he wasn't certain he was ready. The idea of flying, he thought, excites me. But leaving my friend Stalla makes me sad. Good night, he told his elders as he left through a passageway. Even in the dark, he knew it well, partly ramp, partly stairs. When he got to his room, he lit the slender candle on the bedside table. Then he closed the door, undressed, and climbed into his long, warm night garment with a roomy distal pouch for feet. Well separated from the rest of the apartment, his room was constructed in a lumpy outgrowth of the tree. Properly insulated, it was cozy and comfortable. He got into bed and pulled up the covers. Drifting off to sleep, he envisioned himself soaring high above the trees, clinging to the back of an eagle, never suspecting that before the light of morning, his life would be changed forever. Chapter 5. Jilin entered through Hutt's family's front door. He made his way quietly through the warm entryway, coals still glowing in the fireplace, and to the corridor leading to the room he sought. He was cautious, traversing the passageway in the dark, not knowing it as intimately as his cousin. Opening the door slowly, he stepped into the room lit dimly by the candle. He closed the door softly and moved to the bedside.
"Hutt," he whispered huskily, "wake up! I need to talk to you."
Hutt was asleep facing the wall. Jilin nudged his shoulder.
"Wake up! We need to talk now."
Stirring, Hutt turned and was surprised but pleased when he saw the intruder was his cousin and best friend. Jilin was from the Mogur clan, whose tree wasn't far, but Hutt hadn't seen him for days.
"What are you doing here in the middle of the night?"
whispered Hutt, blinking and rubbing sleep from his eyes.
"Did you wake anyone up on the way in?"
"I'm sure no one heard me."
"What are you doing here?" "I need help."
Urgency was in Jilin's voice.
"Tally and I are in serious trouble. Nothing we started, but a terrible situation. We're being followed, and we're in great danger."
Throwing his long feet over the edge of the bed, Hutt sat up, fully awake. His heart was beating fast, his green eyes glimmering in the candlelight. His cousin appeared genuinely frightened and exhausted.
"Where's Tally?" asked Hutt.
"I wish I knew, but I don't," said Jilin.
"What kind of trouble that you didn't start? Who's following you?"
"This will be hard to understand," said Jilin, "but I can't tell you."
"Why?"
"For your sake and your clan's safety, I can say very little. If I say more, it will put you in the same position as me."
"How can telling me make a difference? Did you take something that wasn't yours, or argue with an elder, or interfere with someone's Eilon, or what?"
"I've done nothing wrong. If it were something like that, I'd tell you right away. It's much more important and dangerous. It could be a threat to us all."
Hutt stood up and stared at Jilin. They'd been close since childhood. Hutt had fair hair and was younger and smaller. Jilin was black-haired, handsome, and sturdy in build.
He had deep, dark eyes and was often said to be the best-looking lad in either clan.
"A threat to us all," said Hutt loudly. "Who's following you?"
"Quiet," whispered Jilin. "I wish I could tell more. I wish I could tell you everything. But I've said I can't. You have no choice but to believe me. I need help. I'd like you to come with me. Tonight."
"Tonight? Where?"
"I don't know. I must simply get away. And in a hurry. I'm being followed by a thing. Something you've never heard of."
Becoming desperate, Jilin decided to reveal more to get his cousin's help.
"Something very dangerous is tracking me because of what I know."
"Is this a game, like we played as children?"
"It's no game. The reason I can't tell more is that if I did, you'd be tracked."
"I'd be tracked?"
"Yes. I haven't told anyone about this. My parents, my sister, my brother. Only you."
"Lucky me. Where would we go? I've hardly been farther from home than your tree."
"I need an Eilon. A raven would be best, but you've never flown. Your sister's squirrel would do. You could help me command her."
"What would Blinda think, waking up in the morning and finding Asa gone? Besides, you're too big for her."
Not enamored with Jilin's plan, Hutt wasn't eager to leave his warm room and go out into a cold night. He gasped, and a chill ran through his body as he became aware of a scraping, grating sensation just beneath the level of hearing. Distinct and intense, it seemed to be shaking the room's very fiber.
"It's the Granum," said Jilin. "It's found me. If I stay longer, I'll endanger your clan. When I leave, it will sense that I'm gone and move on looking for me, or Tali. We've got to leave now."
"Why don't you just go home?"
"Because the creatures stalking us will stop at nothing to capture us. They'd destroy anyone defending us or be destroyed themselves. When one of them is killed, others come in numbers and stay until they capture the Kirin the dead Granum was after. Our clan would defend us. Granums would be killed. More would come, and they could easily overwhelm the clan. That's why I can't go home or stay here."
Hutt removed his nightclothes and pulled on his underwear, now convinced something was very wrong.
"What does a Granum look like?"
"We haven't time." The vibrations were becoming stronger. "We've got to get the Eilon. Without one, I'll be captured. The creatures are relentless. I've seen what happens to someone who's caught."
"What? Who was caught?"
rasped an increasingly anxious Hutt. But his cousin shook his head and didn't answer.
"It's following you," said Hutt, reaching for his shirt, "because of what you know. What do you know? Tell me something. How can I go if I know nothing?"
Touching Hutt's right foot in the traditional gesture, Jilin looked his cousin in the eye and spoke calmly.
"You must trust me. I'm in danger that grows by the moment. If I told you my secrets, you also would be hunted. Right now, the Granum wants only me, or anyone like me, with the knowledge. It can't see or sense you in any way, unless you have this knowledge, or threaten its existence, or its attacks on me."
The gratings were becoming ever more intense, as though an earthquake were shaking the small room. Fumbling with his pant laces, Hutt wished he could awaken his mother, father, and grandfather, but knew they didn't have time and Jilin wouldn't tell them anything anyway. He needed an Eilon. But Hutt sensed he needed something more, a companion, an ally.
"How long would we be gone?" asked Hutt, opening the door to his room, not convinced he was going anywhere.
"A few days, or in all honesty, we might not return." Hutt had verve and daring, but this, at last, was too much.
"I'll call both Eilon, but I don't think I'll be going with you."
They hurried down the corridor, through the warm entryway, and out the front door. As Hutt closed the door, his mother turned over in her sleep. Half awake, she felt sadness and loss deep in her heart.
"It must have been a dream," she told herself,
and fell into a fretful slumber until dawn. And with each awakening for unnumbered mornings to come, emptiness and melancholy would return to her anew.
Kieran's The Spell of Noan, written and narrated by James D. Priest.
To learn more about Kieran's, visit www.kieranbooks.com.
You have been listening to A Good Book on Sun Sounds of Arizona.